Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Raptors Reasonablest Podcast. I'm your host, Blake Murphy. Joining me on the line, despite being quite despondent due to allergies and the continued failures of the Canadian men's senior basketball program, Eric Kareem. Eric, what's up, man?
Yeah, you can hear that I've been bawling. I've been crying even more nasal than usual. Man, that was... it's different with the Raptors in Canada basketball. I think part of that is because of how long we've talked about Canada basketball's potential, and part of it is that it happened, at least the big stage, the biggest stage, is only available every 4 years, so that makes each time, you know, the leverage goes up, the meaning goes up, and that was a new way to lose a game. So, yeah.
Sure was. So, we are going to primarily talk about Canada basketball on this podcast. As a reminder, for all our written stuff, you can go to theathletic.com/Raptors, or if you're not a subscriber yet, theathletic.com/WeTheSix to get a discounted subscription there. We are going to, you know, the last week has been heavy on Canada basketball stuff as the men's team tried to qualify. We're going to pivot back to, you know, your Raptors draft stuff, your Raptors offseason stuff, and then eventually the Canadian women's program over the next little bit. But today, we have to commiserate over Canada basketball. So if you forgot or you weren't following along, Canada was part of a six-team Olympic qualifying tournament in Victoria. The reason they were in this position is because for Olympic qualification, there are only 12 spots in the Olympics. One goes to the host, Japan, who Nick Nurse has declared we're all rooting for now, for Utah and for Takeshi. And then seven spots in that tournament were determined via the World Cup. And that's not the top seven necessarily. It's based on zone. But Canada was not high enough ranked in that tournament for the Americas. So they then got put into these four last chance qualifying tournaments. If you've been following the program for a long time, you remember them going to the Philippines in 2016 and, you know, losing to France, because these tournaments only allow one team to move on to the Olympics. There are four concurrent tournaments for those final spots. So, Canada hosting in Victoria, Canada basketball spending the money to host, and then the pandemic hits, and for one game only, they could have 10% capacity. You still hope that there's some level of home court advantage.
Or at least the lack of home court advantage for another team.
Yes, I mean, look.
Which has been a problem historically as well.
Yeah, Serbia and Lithuania both playing in finals today as we record this in their home country. So that's that was the method, that was the intention for Canada. They started off okay. Their opener against Greece, they start slowly. We expected that. They played no exhibition games. There's not a lot of continuity on the roster. Only one player held over from the 2019 World Cup. And they come back and they, you know, they look like the team we hoped for the second half of that game. And they beat Greece 97-91. And that's the big first hurdle, because their next game's against China, who, you know, you can always lose in these formats. And we saw Uruguay almost pull off multiple upsets. But Canada beats China 109-79. They win the group. This is a very short tournament. It's you play the two round-robin games, and then you get cross-matched with the top teams in the other pool. Canada played the Czech Republic on Saturday. Czech Republic had gotten smoked by Turkey and barely survived a game against Uruguay, which would have changed Canada's matchup had they pulled that upset off.
I believe they were up by 17 on Uruguay in the second quarter, and then Uruguay made a spirited comeback.
Yes, and missed the buzzer
three
beater,
at the buzzer, or missed a shot at the buzzer.
Yeah, so they won 80-79 to just narrowly get through. So if you're wondering how things shake out and just how random a tournament like this is, and this is going to be additionally frustrating for Canadian fans, I think, Greece pounded Turkey last night. So Greece is sitting in the finals, a team that Canada already beat. They smoked Turkey, who smoked the Czech Republic, and transitive property doesn't work in basketball, but you have all these factors, and you would have liked Canada's chances against the Czechs. As it were, Canada was outplayed for most of the game. There were some of the usual FIBA officiating questions, but as we say all the time with the Raptors, or if you're a fan of combat sports, you know, don't let it go to the judges' scorecards. If the game was close enough to swing on one whistle here and there, you should have made sure it wasn't that close to begin with. Canada didn't do that. They shot really poorly all game. They forced a lot of check turnovers, but couldn't really take advantage of that. They were down 10 with 57 seconds left. Somehow erased that deficit to force overtime. Andrew Wiggins coming up clutch. Andrew Wiggins coming up clutch again in overtime. But on the final possession of the game, Tomas Satoransky isolating against Lugansz Dort, which if you're Canada and you could pick one defender to defend in that situation, it's Dort. He defends it incredibly, two hands up to try to block the shot, and Satoransky rainbows it over him off glass and in, 103-101 for the Czech Republic. So the Czech Republic and Greece will play Sunday in Victoria, with the winner going on to the Olympics. The Canadian.
And you skipped the part where Canada got a great look to tie the game on a inbound pass that was sort of the reverse of the OG Adenobi play from the other side of the court.
Yes.
For a two and a three, and it gets Trey Lyles a very open look, and it goes in and out. Like, one Czech's got a bad shot, quote-unquote bad shot, from their best player.
Who are you, Paul George?
A bad shot, and they made it. And Canada got a good shot, although not from their best player, and it didn't go in.
Yeah, Lyles had a rough game. He was on the floor a lot late, in part because Dwight Powell fouled out. Lyles was also, you know, pretty solid defensively, especially in the second half. He had 11 rebounds, which was a team high on a night where Canada could grab no rebounds. Lyles getting the shot there, well, it's tough in these situations, right? You have 1.8 seconds, so you have to trigger to the guy who's going to shoot, and the opposing team is going to be defending your best players really aggressively. So drawing up that play, similar to OG getting that shot against the Celtics, you're picking a guy who is maybe going to be a little open. And Lyles just missed it. Finished the game 1-for-7. I'm getting interrupted by Luna, the dog I'm dog-sitting, who is an absolute terror. She was not happy with the outcome last night and tried to chew up my couch about it. Canada basketball, disappointing themselves, disappointing Eric Green, disappointing Luna. Eric, what more? I don't know, man. We both wrote about it. It's very dispiriting. What's your feeling on it the morning after?
It's a bummer. I think we'll get to big picture lessons, but if you look at the 45 minutes of that game, it's hard to say that the team that executed its game plan for more of those minutes won the game. So you can't shake your fist at the outcome too much, even though we just ran down how the last two possessions played out. Like, there was certainly a bit of randomness there, but I don't think anybody watched that game and thought the wrong team won, other than, you know, despite those two possessions, despite the officiating, a snake-bitten Dwight Powell picking up sort of phantom fouls.
Not only the phantom fouls, but the, like... So there were the phantom fouls on him, there were the no calls he got at the other end, and then there was also the element of, there's one play that stood out to me where he has this great defensive possession against Balvin, who's posting him up. Balvin was a monster most of that game.
Yeah,
Powell stands him up, defends him well, and then Nikhil Alexander-Walker gets called for a foul on like a little touch reach-in. So even when Powell wasn't getting the foul, he was still having his defensive efforts neutralized.
Yeah, and I think, like, the call that everybody will want to argue was the...
Lyles.
The unsportsmanlike foul on Lyles, which was just, you know, how can something be unsportsmanlike when the guy's not even looking at him? As far as I could tell, Trey Lyles was trying to keep his balance, as opposed to falling to the floor, and his elbow makes contact with Balvin's head, and you know, Balvin's head is way up there. Yeah. So
in general, I'm okay with the rules kind of erring on the side of, look, when it comes to other people's
headshots
heads,
are bad.
Yeah, you're responsible to be in control of your body, and incidental shots to the head are still shots to the head. However, there's a little bit of letter of the law versus spirit of the law with these things, and we got, because it's FIBA, we got to hear the referees arguing over it, and we got to hear the one referee overrule the other referee who didn't think it was unsportsmanlike.
Yeah,
it was
like,
pretty frustrating. But like again, it,
I would so go ahead. I would just say, like, I agree with you when it's like reckless and careless, then yeah, like make players think about it. But what is a player supposed to do when he's falling down?
And he trips
other
over
than
his teammate in the
air.
Yeah,
other than to try and stop himself from falling down. Like, it's, you can't rule out, you can't, you know, make fouls against human, you know, basic human instinct to not fall. Like, it's just insane. Saying that, it got, instead of two fouls, of two free throws for Balvin, it gave the Czechs four free throws.
And possession. And
possession. They made three of those free throws, promptly turned it over. So it's not as if the worst case scenario played out, but, you know, that's one extra point and a few extra seconds. You can't play the whole, you know, they would have won by one if that didn't happen because the butterfly effect and all that crap,
yeah.
But it's still, you know, frustrating.
Yeah. They would have won by, like, 60 if they hit all their threes.
Yeah, and that's the lesson. Like, and I think, so though, you asked me what my reaction is, and it's mostly what you said. It's like, you don't like it, pitch better.
Yeah.
And
we've talked about this a lot with
the
Raptors
better
in the playoffs
yeah.
some years, too. And like, you know, every fan base in basketball thinks the refs have it out for them and they have the wrong end of free throws and stuff, but the real takeaway is that you can't leave yourself in positions where one whistle swings the game, right? And that's obviously this is a hard tournament. Qualifying for the Olympics is a hard thing to do. Otherwise, the Canadian men would have done it since 2000. But yeah, you entered this game as a pretty significant favorite. You were the favorite in the tournament, and it's not like you're not the team that is supposed to be in the position where one whistle can swing it for you, or two whistles can swing it for you. You know, that's supposed to be it's the underdog that needs everything to go right. It shouldn't be the favorite, and that's what Canada was, at least on paper, in these games. So,
yeah, and I think in terms of, you know, pitch better in this case was, A, have a better, more complete plan to deal with the Czechs inside out strategy, and, you know, part of that is definitely roster limitations. But also there were just some quick shots in the first half, and Nick Nurse alluded to it post-game, said they were sort of baited into, you know, early shots in the possession, in the shot clock. And that's where I get to what I think we're going to spend a lot of this time talking about, is just having guys who know how to play together. And there's, you know, there's a reason Canada came out slowly and had to adjust in all three of these games.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, as far back as when they told us that they weren't playing exhibition games, you know, we had been at least mildly critical of that, you know, recognizing, of course, that it's a pandemic and those things cost money, and logistically maybe it wasn't really possible, but, you know, a two-week training camp and then you have the third game you're playing as a group is a single elimination game, is not ideal, especially when, yeah, there were five or six guys from that 2015 team on this roster, but there was only one from 2019. Like, I don't remember what it was like to play with some guy 5 or 6 years ago, under a different head coach, with everyone playing different roles, you know, other than Wiggins, I guess, who kind of effectively slotted back into the top scorer role. And he's even a guy where, like, he did this in a couple games. He was their best and most effective scorer. Like, Wiggins and Barrett did what they're supposed to do and carried the scoring load. But I thought Wiggins, like, was maybe the most guilty of, individually, of just not being into the game early and kind of waiting until he really had to turn it on. Now, having said that, he was also probably their second best player in the tournament, so it doesn't fall on him.
But he was also in quasi-foul trouble against the Czechs, I will say.
Yeah, I made the joke on Twitter that he picked up an early third foul, and it was three more plays than I remember him being involved in. But he was awesome down the stretch and awesome as a scorer in general. So, you know, I guess the big takeaway here is for so long with Canada basketball, we talked, you know, they went from not having enough talent to then having enough talent, but the talent doesn't show up. And now the talent does show up. And I've saw people making comments about the turnout not being good enough or guys not being committed enough or whatever. You had 8 NBA players on this roster. It is incredibly unrealistic to think that injuries and contract status and young guys on developing teams and stuff like that are ever going to be able to commit with 100% turnout. And I think what this tournament showed is that that's not enough on its own anyway. Like, sure, maybe with Shea and Jamal Murray, they run things here because those are very, very good players, or Dylan Brooks or Kelly Olynyk, but they got the turnout. Like, on paper, Canada was better than any of these other teams based on the talent of their individual players, and that didn't do it. So I think now, you know, we've kind of gone through these phases as Canada basketball tries to rebuild since 2000, where it's like, okay, well, we need talent. Okay, well, we need talent to turn out. Okay, well, now we need talent to turn out consistently, so there's some level of connectivity and, you know, chemistry with that group year over year. My question for you, Eric, is that possible? Because not only will things like contract statuses and free agency and injuries happen every year, there's also, you know, like, if you want these teams to play, have longer camps and play more exhibition games, then the ask you're making of these NBA players and agents and teams is larger as well. You know, we're heading right into the next Olympic cycle next year, and I guess, is that continuity going to be possible? Because we saw for this last era that, like, it was Corey and Tristan, and then it was Corey, Kelly, and Dwight, and, you know, it certainly looked in this tournament like Corey might be at the end of his utility as a starting level point guard at this level. I don't know, man. Are we talking about the same stuff in 2024?
Yeah, so this is the question I basically asked in my column. And Nick, I asked it to Nick Nurse, and he basically said the important thing is to have a core group. But is that possible? And like, you can look at the sort of, If you're going to the mid to early 20 guys in their 20s that were so excited about, that, you know, Jamal Murray, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, RJ Barrett, Lou Dort, there are reasons why you think they'd all be more committed than not, right? Like, Murray has always indicated that. But he didn't play in 2019. I forget if that was an injury situation, but nobody played in 2019.
Yeah, that was an injury. I think he had an ankle. Yeah. I remember talking to him at OVO Center. Like, that was one where I think it was him and Dylan Brooks and RJ were all there, but not officially there.
RJ is the general manager's son, so you would expect, you know, him to play more often than not. Lou Dort is a competitive maniac, so you would expect him to err on the side of playing. And then there's Alexander Walker and Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, who are cousins, and you would expect that they want to play, but just to play together. And these guys seem to have a real closeness, and they want more reps to play together. And like Nick Nurse spoke about, like, when this group gets together, there is a, you know, a warmth and all of that. But no matter how much they, in theory, want to play, like, we listened, Blake and I, we listened to Kem Birch say, yeah, I'm going to be there. Yeah, I'm going to be there. And then, like, obviously, this isn't to criticize Kem Birch, but this is a guy who, in his head, was very, very committed to Canada basketball. And then he looked at the reality of free agency, no matter how much it seems like the Raptors might bring him back, like, there are no guarantees, and he couldn't play.
What's the old Dwayne Caseyism? If ifs and buts were candy and nuts?
Yeah. not couldn't play, but chose not to for reasons I think that, you know, people will criticize. And, you know, the counter to that is Corey Joseph played and he has a very lightly guaranteed contract for next season. So it was possible to play. We don't know what the Pistons have told him legally or otherwise. But guys are going to be in this situation repeatedly. So what does it mean to have a committed core? Like, is it eight guys and four of those guys are always there? Is it the same five guys? Because I don't think the same five guys you can ever say are definitely going to be there. So I think what you're hoping is you identify those 10 guys and you hope for it's a year where there's more than 50% turnout. But again, that the very, you know, nature of like those guys changing from year to year means that the roles will change within a given year. And when you talk about like the best example I can think of is the golden age in Argentina, you had Scola and Ginobili and Prigioni. Prigioni's Argentine, right? Or is he Italian?
He is Argentinian-Italian, yeah. He's both. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure he played internationally for Argentina.
Yeah. You had those guys filling those roles consistently, and they knew how to play off of each other. And yesterday, you saw a team that returned 9 players from the World Cup, and they knew how to execute their game plan more quickly than Canada did. And it's a huge hurdle. Are we good? So to get back to your question, I hope not, but it's possible that we're still going to be talking about this in 2024. And I think, you know, skepticism, as you know, every time around, I want to say, this is the year you got to believe, because if we follow sports and don't believe, why are we following sports? But skepticism is warranted.
Sure is. So I guess another question for you, Eric, this is more on the, you know, let's look a little more tactically at the roster and the talent pool. And, you know, we can say that continuity will go a long way and talent turning out will go a long way. And those things are true. But Canada had some weaknesses in this tournament. And they're ones that I think are kind of hard to address with roster construction, because you're going to want, you know, so often you're going to want at least with 8 or 9 of your 12 roster spots to just have the best guys. Yeah. And, you know, maybe 11, 12 are specialist spots. You know, that's what we thought Andrew Nicholson might play until none of the bigs turned out. So Nicholson was thrust into a bigger rotation role. And that was, you know, Michael Mulder kind of played that shooting specialist role if shooting specialists never saw the floor or got touches. So I look at this team and I think there were three things that stood out from a skill and talent standpoint that I don't know just commitment and, you know, turnout resolve on their own. And I think the first one is three-point shooting. You know, Canada probably, if that tournament was 82 games long, would have been a better three-point shooting team than that. But they're not a great three-point shooting group in general. The second one is that the program is a little thin at point guard. Corey Joseph looks like he's, you know, I mean, he should be not
he's
quite
on the back end of his high utility.
Yeah, he's not quite ready for the Dornacamp role, but, you know, he's probably a little better suited to coming off the bench at that level. And being kind of a vet leader and floor general and stuff, he was not able to do a lot as the lead point guard in that series offensively. And there isn't, you know, Nikhil Alexander-Walker had a very good tournament, but he's not a natural point guard. Unless we think Shea is going to show up, obviously that fixes a lot at point guard. He's awesome. Yeah. But there aren't a ton of point guards in the pipeline. Trey Bill-Haynes barely played. He's a really solid guy. You've got some guys like Keza Keen internationally who could potentially figure in later. Kevin Pangos, who's always been a commit. But if you look around the NBA talent and the top EuroLeague talent and you look around what's coming up in the pipeline, you know, I've watched these first two U19 World Cup games, and they are running Ryan Nembhard into the ground because they have...
Younger Nembhard. My bad.
Yes. Andrew Nembhard is no longer U19.
Yeah, he's not under 19. Yeah. I was confused seeing the Nembhard name pop up in the under 19. Yeah. I was like, that guy's 21.
They're running Nembhard into the ground because on that roster, too, he's the only natural point guard. I think this morning he didn't take a sit until late in the third quarter. And I think they played 10 minutes with him not on the floor, and they had 7 turnovers. So this is like point guard is the position of weakness when you look at the developmental pipeline. And then the third thing is bigs, and that's not something you can really just fix.
Just grow a 7-footer.
Zach Edey is like 7'5".
So it's fine.
But he's, you know, I think Charles Bediako is the better big man prospect coming up. I guess what I'm going at is the point guard pipeline is a little thinner than other positions. There are lots of good wings coming up. They have a lot of wings to choose from already. But the big man position is the one where, like, I think universal turnout is the most important, because the drop off after the first couple centers that they have is pretty significant.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I'm most concerned, because, like, if you look at this tournament, Canada has Andrew Wiggins and RJ Barrett, and with the exception of maybe a guy like Chetty Osman, there are no players like that in this tournament. Like, that's where Canada's advantage is. It's like athletic, shot creating,
speed,
wings. Speed, athleticism, and that's where Canada's most depth is. But that's, you know, the NBA. Those are the best guys to have. But how that relates is, like, I think, you know, they're not point guards, but they have playmaking skills. So I think, you know, a good coach can, you know, can find ways to create, even if you're a bit thinner at point guard than you are on the wing, with that creation ability.
Speaking of good coaches, Eric, Nick Nurse committed to Canada basketball through this Olympic cycle. He was non-committal after the game, as you'd expect, about his future with the program. Said he loves coaching, said he wants to see this team be the best it can be. Do you expect Nick Nurse to continue on with Canada basketball?
I'm always hesitant to predict anything with Canada basketball. I don't know. I don't know how much he was getting paid. I don't know what their budget is.
I can't imagine it was a lot, knowing Canada basketball.
If I had to guess, I'd say yes. I think he, like, genuinely loves coaching, and if he committed after these, you know, coaching some more after the last two Raptor seasons and how complicated they were, just from a practical point of view, I think if he, you know, a more predictable schedule, knock on wood, would make it a more enticing job. But I don't know. You know, we know that MLSE and Canada basketball have a pretty good relationship. Wink, wink. So if I had to bet, I'd say yes. And I know some people were critical of Nurse late game, or not late game, throughout the game. And, you know, when a team starts poorly 3 games in a row, that's not without its merit. I have trouble blaming him for too much in this tournament. I don't think there was, you know, other than maybe Mulder, who I would have liked to see a bit more against a lot of those zones. I don't think he used the wrong guys. I don't think the strategy was obviously way off. Like, they were obviously just, they couldn't find a good way to cover up for the size depth. And that goes back to your previous, or not the size depth, the size mismatch. And that goes back to the question you asked before this. And that's where I'm most concerned, because it's great to have, like, 6'9 power forwards as center, and that allows you to get out in transition and all those good things. But when a team is controlling the half court like the Czechs were yesterday and is doing basically everything, it said Canada had 14 fast break points. I remember like four. But when they're like shutting that tap off, then it's, you know, pretty useful to have a 7-footer in there to be able to defend. If not straight up, then with less help than Canada was giving Powell or Lyles or Nicholson. And I think that's going to be a major issue going forward. As for Nurse, I don't know. If I had to bet, I would bet he'll be back. But we will see.
All right. So what does it look like from here? Logistically, this is what the next kind of condensed Olympic cycle looks like. Because we're working with a 3-year Olympic cycle after these games instead of a 4-year one. So the next step in the process is the 2022 America's Championship. Those are held in September 2022. So right away you've got, hey, they're going to be in a close time zone. The travel requirement isn't going to be too arduous. Assuming the NBA sticks to their normal schedule as they intend to, then, you know, September is kind of the best time for NBA commitment when, you know, you've had your break postseason, you've had some injury recovery time, you're still a couple weeks out from training camp, so it can almost be like a ramp-up event for you, whereas when the World Cup's in China, that's very difficult with the travel component, but a FIBA Americas Championship is a little simpler. That tournament does not have a host yet. Hosting a tournament costs money, as Canada Basketball learned with this one. Canada Basketball has not historically had a lot of money. I do wonder if maybe when selecting hosts, FIBA would give some consideration to the fact that Canada put in to host this one and didn't really get to host it in the way that they would have hoped or FIBA would have hoped or what the intention is with FIBA spreading around the events. Could you see Canada hosting that one?
I think it's unlikely.
Yeah, me too.
You know, just because Canada didn't get the full benefit of this hosting this tournament doesn't mean they'll suddenly have more money to, like, it still costs money to host this tournament.
Drake, come through, man.
And maybe even more money than it would have cost otherwise.
The OVO Americas.
Just put it at OVO. That'd be great. I bet against it. I would be shocked if it's in Canada. I don't know any other way to answer that question based on Canada basketball's history.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Yeah. The America's Championship is a legitimate major tournament. It's always a lot of fun. It's something the team should take pride in. So don't write that. Like, this is not the, hey, they're playing two games in the Dominican Republic with a bunch of guys pulled out of, like, second and third tier Euro teams or like, Anthony Bennett, who hasn't played in a year, suiting up. Bennett looked fine-ish, by the way. I don't know. I'd like to see him back in the G League next year to see if he can pick up where he left off in 2019.
He was no Blake Schilb, who also basically took the year off.
Yeah. Also, very embarrassing, I spelt Blake Schilb's name wrong in my piece last night.
His first name?
And not the Schilb part, yeah. Sanaya messaged me, our editor, Sanaya, she messaged me, and she's like, I thought this was a really cool name, Black Schilb. Like maybe thinking it was like Raw Gunna on the Korean team or something like that. And nope, I just spelt my own name wrong.
Balake!
Yeah, oops. So the America's Tournament is not only valuable because it's a fun tournament and it's worth winning. 7 teams from that tournament punched their ticket to the 2023 World Cup. Now, the World Cup, as we talked about in 2019, to some basketball countries is the marquee event. Canada and the U.S. have kind of a Olympic-centric look on the major international sports. a lot of the European and South American countries, the World Cup is the event. It's a bigger event with 32 teams. It's much harder to win because, you know, you can lose a game like Canada couldn't do against the Czech, but you got to win a lot more too. It's a longer tournament. It's a deeper tournament. It's a longer time commitment because, you know, those games could play out over the course of a month. It's a big one. And as Canada knows all too well, there are some Olympic berths on the line in the World Cup. So you have the Americas, which feed into the World Cup the following year. And in the World Cup, if they keep the Olympic qualification the same for 2024, the top two placing teams from the Americas in the World Cup would then qualify for the Olympics. I think at this point, Canada's probably pretty tired of these last chance Olympic qualifiers and would much rather get in by being one of the top two Americas teams at the World Cup. So you can see a path where we've got this 2021 Olympic cycle that came up short. And then they do 2022 Americas, which fall at a location and a time window that's a little better for turnout. And then that feeds into the 2023 World Cup, which then, hey, maybe you jump right to the Olympics in 2024. And you could see how, if things break right, Canada basketball still manages to build this momentum we've been hoping for, despite this 2021 misstep again. However, the other path is one we've relived every four-year cycle, so it's not a guaranteed thing.
Yeah, and you mentioned like the top seven teams from the FIBA AmeriCup go to the World Cup, so like Canada should get there. But I think the value is what you laid out. It's a longer tournament, and as we were just talking about, like the need to get reps for a core group of players, like, you know, whether or not Canada qualifies for the World Cup, even if that's not really in significant doubt, those reps give you a better chance, as we just saw, to maybe be one of the top two finishers among the Americas in the World Cup and qualify straight for the Olympics.
Yeah, and on top of what we talked about, the chemistry and continuity and stuff. Well, maybe you play 10 games in the AmeriCup and then you play 8 or 9 in the World Cup, and suddenly all these guys who have zero caps together, like I think Canada had three players that have never played for the senior national team in this tournament. Dornekamp has double what anyone else has. You know, suddenly you've got these guys who maybe it's not the exact same group of guys, and maybe it's not, you know, super, you know, everyone in the same role and stuff like that. But even if it's not the same group of guys, you're then pulling from a pool of guys with 10 or 15 or 18 games of senior national experience.
Yeah, and you hope it's like the coaching staff has some consistency, and to the extent that you can, you know, we're not going to go through every player's contract situation here. That's sort of
a year-by-year thing.
Yeah. But you hope there's enough consistency from a roster standpoint, from a coaching standpoint, that gives you the equity to leverage that in bigger situations, like a quarterfinal in the World Cup if they should get there, or a last chance tournament if they end up there. So they're not always battling from that experience deficit and that cohesion deficit. And like, those are the two things that, you know, Canada can only lose to more experienced, more cohesive teams that are less talented so many times before we draw conclusions that those things are pretty important. And that Canada's depth, while, you know, clearly, quote unquote, better than a lot of other countries, is not so great. And the individual talent is not so elite that they can necessarily get by without giving thought and gaining some of that experience and cohesion. And that's why next summer's tournament will be important, and then the World Cup will speak for itself.
One last question about the senior team, and it's the most awkward one to discuss, and it, you know, came up a little bit when Canada put that moonshot roster list out in 2019 and then no one actually showed up. It's an awkward one because obviously RJ Barrett at this stage is one of, if not the most important player to what they want to do here. Rowan Barrett as the GM, is that something that you think will be revisited?
Again, like, I don't know.
Betting on inertia is always a good bet, if that's where you're going with this.
Yeah, like, what did he do wrong with assembling this roster? And did he not get, like, a great or a very good coach to lead that roster? I don't think there's a huge appetite for change, especially when we come out of this tournament looking at, like, the main problem with Canada basketball is that
lack
constant
of stability.
Change. Like if he were doing an obviously poor job in recruiting and in setting that foundation, then I'd say, yeah, change it up. But he obviously likes the job, or I shouldn't say obviously, but I think he did a good enough job to get this, to get the most talent on the floor. He got a good NBA coach, and, you know, I know there are whispers behind the scenes about him sometimes, but you end up, it's about personnel. That job is about getting the best personnel you can, and I don't think, and again, while we may, like, be angry or upset that this wasn't the absolute best roster, I think it's not a fail. Like I wrote in my column, this isn't a failure of talent. And that's true on the player side. That's true on the coaching side. It's a failure to adequately develop the program and make it more cohesive. And is that part of Barrett's job? Sure. But that's also just something that takes time and is a structural thing that goes beyond the job of the general manager of the senior men's national team.
Yeah. Here's the real answer. Hire me in some nebulous Lee Jenkins-like role to help foster commitment and turnout and player development. And I'll just write cool stories about whatever Lee Jenkins does for the Clippers. Let me do that for Canada basketball.
Lee Jenkins is a storyteller, man.
Yeah.
The Clippers storyteller.
So let's end on a little bit of positivity. Obviously, there is a continued growth in the pool of players that Canada is pulling from. You know, we could, the list we had in our original Raptors reserve list months ago. Was like 50 or 60 names long that they could be pulling from. And there are more names coming up. They had three U19 guys in senior camp with them before sending them back to the U19 team. As mentioned, the U19 team's off to a 2-0 start and, you know, is headed for, if everything goes well, you know, there's a semifinal matchup with the U.S. that looks like it's in their way. Maybe there's a tougher quarterfinal matchup on their way, but they beat Lithuania, which was their toughest pool stage game. And that team has guys who are probably lottery picks in each of the next three drafts, and this upcoming draft has a couple guys that are possibly, you know, the second rounder slash two-way type of guys. There's talent coming.
And, like, look at a guy like Dort. Like, he came out of, you know, kind of nowhere, and there will be more guys like this.
Yeah.
That, too.
Yeah. Shout out to Josh Primo and AJ Lawson, like, the two biggest winners of the Combine slash G League Elite Camp cycle, to where I think they're probably both going to stay in the draft now. The deadline for that is the 7th, by the way, so we'll know a little bit more about that later this week. And then the other area for positivity, and we try to mention this as much as possible, and we'll be writing about this team at the Olympics as well, is that the women's program remains in pretty good shape.
Let's go!
The 12-person roster that they put out for the Olympics is a very, very good one on paper. Kim Smith-Gauthier was able to, you know, the IOC finally bent on allowing breastfeeding mothers to bring their infants to Tokyo, which is one of those extremely obvious decisions that IOC had to make seem like the toughest decision in the world.
Look, whenever the IOC ends up making the right decision, let's just call it a win and move on.
Anyway. The hope is that Natalie Achan was healthy in time. She's been out with a minor knee injury for the Minnesota Lynx. You've got Kia Nurse and Bridget Carlton, and these, you know, there is... The women's side has a great mix of youth and developmental pieces. Letitia Amaher from South Carolina, who's on the kind of younger and higher ceiling side. You have this good mix of veteran program experience and players on the upswing of their development curve to where there's some upside there. The last couple major tournaments, Canada has kind of bounced in that 4-8 range where, hey, it's the U.S. up top and then some combo of Australia, Spain, France, not dissimilar from what it looks like at the top of the men's pool. But Canada's right there. And Canada enters this tournament ranked 4th in the world. You know, the like on the men's side, there is not a lot of separation for between maybe like, let's say 2-7. So it's entirely possible this is a quarterfinals run and that's where it ends. But it's also entirely possible that the Canadian women are competing for a medal in Tokyo. And I think, you know, if you had the enthusiasm and passion for the men's side, hoping they qualify for the Olympics, don't sleep on the fact that the women are there and the women have a longer track record of success in these events. And, you know, the sort of they're a great blueprint for what the men's side eventually wants to be able to do in terms of blending experience and youth and, you know, in their case, WNBA versus NBA talent.
Yeah, like if you remember the 2012 Olympics, the London Olympics, when the women's soccer team made that run and had that super memorable game against the United States, like I've always sort of hoped for the women's program. It didn't quite materialize in 2016, but they're, as you said, they're right there. They have, you know, I don't think anybody's beaten the United States, but they have the talent to go up against any other country in the world. And you just hope that they have that sort of run in them, because when that happens, it's freaking magical. And it's why we follow sports. So pay attention to them. We're going to do our best to cover them and give you more insight into what we hope is one of the better stories of the Tokyo Olympics, assuming they still happen, which they probably will.
Wait, assuming what?
The Tokyo Olympics happen. They're going to happen, but, you know, there's still a pandemic going on.
Okay, so, I was going to say, yeah, there have been 3 positive COVID tests already as athletes arrive.
Yeah, it'll be it's going to happen. I'm just, you know, it's in the year of our Lord 2021, I am always hedging my bets.
By the way, for format purposes, the women's side follows the same format as the men. So Canada's in a group with South Korea, Serbia, and Spain. The top 2 teams from group play move on, as well as the best 2 of the 3 third place teams. So this is a situation where, with apologies to the Lithuanian U19 team that was very upset at Ryan Nembhard scoring with the lead with 1 second left on the clock, point differential matters. You got to run that score up if you can. Canada tips off on July 26th against Serbia. They then play the 29th against South Korea and August 1st against Spain. The quarterfinals and onward would then run August 4th to August 8th. So keep an eye out for that. I think that's it.
Yeah. Man. Hope we're not doing this again in 3 years.
Yeah, me too. You know, maybe I'll be who knows? Maybe I'll be a naturalized citizen of another national program at that point. I'm going to pull a Blake Shilb and adopt a different home country so I can cover an Olympics.
Find a nice Czech girl to settle down with.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Czech's not the team I would hitch my horse to for 2024.
I mean, they've never made the Olympics, so this is the Olympic tournament, so this is a huge game for them.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn. Like, I want the Czechs to win today for that reason. And, like, Satoransky's cool, and the Blake Shilb story is great, and I've always had an affinity for Jan Vesely, and then, you know, the big man who looks like they put Myrtle in a, they did experiments on James Myrtle, Andrej Balvin. And yeah, Eric, I can see the look on your face. I'm taking that joke from the DMs to the podcast. I didn't tweet it though, because Myrtle won't know who Andrej Balvin is, and our basketball, anyone who knows who Andrej Balvin is, might not know who James Myrtle is, but yeah, but I'm also, you know, the Greece fans were pretty, like, down on their luck. And with the turnout and Spanoulis retiring and stuff, and then you look ahead to the Olympics and, you know, maybe they get a guy back or something like that. I'm torn on tonight's game.
Well, as somebody who lives near the Danforth, I need the least chances for excitement, the better. I don't want any sort of, you know, risk of chaos in this in this area. I think soccer would do it over basketball. Yeah. Don't get me wrong, but you know, I want to play it safe here. Go check.
Wow, turning your back on your own neighborhood, unbelievable.
Well, Little Prague will be rocking though.
Yeah. All right, that's it for this Canada basketball podcast wrap. Obviously, a disappointing outcome. But some reason to look ahead to the U19 World Cup that's ongoing, the women's basketball team in the Olympics a little later on. I don't have much more to say.
Yeah, we'll be talking headed into the draft, I'm sure. That will be probably our next time doing this.
Yeah, theathletic.com/we the six if you're not already subscribed to the written side of the site. And I'm just going to rant for 1 second here a little bit, because we talked about it a little bit last episode, and maybe not in as certain terms as we could have, especially with Canada Day having just passed. There is absolutely a dissonance between rooting for these athletes that have Canada on the front of their jerseys and are united by their Canadian citizenship, and not being particularly happy with Canada as a country and a government right now. You saw the Canadian men's team wearing the orange patch on the shoulder of their jersey to recognize and show respect to Indigenous peoples. You know, we all need to go a lot further than that. The history of this country is built on Indigenous genocide, and as they continue to you know, uncover the unmarked graves of these mass graves from residential schools, and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission becomes a talking point again, strongly urge you to check out resources that I've tweeted or retweeted. Eric, I think you did as well. You know, even things like, hey, we included some land acknowledgments in the articles we did, because those games are taking place on Indigenous land out in Victoria. Engage with that stuff, because there is, I think we can hold two thoughts at the same time. I think we can try to hold our country accountable for the historic atrocities, while also, you know, looking at 12 basketball players who come from the same place as us and hoping they do well. I think we can hold both of those thoughts at the same time. But if you're, especially if you're feeling some dissonance as you root for a group of players wearing Canada on the front, engage with that stuff. Read the Truth and Reconciliation Commission reports. You know, educate yourself. There's a lot of relearning to do that we don't traditionally get brought up hearing about. The history of this country's treatment and the present of this country's treatment of Indigenous peoples is really a shame and needs reconciling. So just wanted to end on that note, because
lots of good places to donate to. If you can afford to. I'm not in the business of telling people how to spend their money, other than forget that. But if you have the disposable income or just a few bucks, every dollar counts and can help further these. It's weird to even call them causes, just like to help us be a better country.
Yeah.
Like that's what it's about. You want, like, we have Canada Day. Be proud of Canada. But also acknowledge, like, if that pride is getting in the way of acknowledging some hugely, hugely, you know, beyond problematic aspects of the country, then you're not even proud of your country. Like, you're just proud of an idea that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So,
For more information, you can go to nctr.ca/records/reports. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission reports are there. Some stuff on the residential school bodies that are being found. A lot of additional resources, including some free PDFs to help continue learning about that. Thanks so much for listening, guys. We'll talk to you again probably not this coming week, but unless this comes out on Monday instead of Sunday, then we are talking to you this week. But the following week, maybe, or the week after that, to talk some draft stuff. The draft is July 29th. The Raptors have pick number 4, 46, and 47. And again, we'll be covering a little bit the U19 team and then the women's Olympic team when that starts up. Eric, thanks so much, man.
Thanks, Blake. Go Chucks. See ya.